remembering babies who were once supposed to be forgotten.
I think maybe they wanted to spare my feelings, not bring it up.
We'll hear why a very special memorial is healing hearts, and we'll look at programs aimed at saving mothers and babies. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51% The Women's Perspective. Our culture has changed a great deal from the world our mothers and grandmothers knew. Birth, for many parents, is now an event where fathers are welcomed, where mothers have choices, and where invasive procedures are saved for emergencies. But sometimes a joyful event turns tragic, and for women who lost babies 30, 40, 50 years ago, the death of a child was a bewildering, not to be spoken of loss. Many mothers never even saw the babies they'd lost. One upstate New York cemetery is trying to heal that wound. More than 400 fetuses and infants were buried in a mass grave in what was known as the maternity plot at the back of the Most Holy Redeemer Cemetery in Niskayuna, New York, between 1951 and 1973. Maureen McGinnis is Family Services Manager at the cemetery. It has now opened what it believes is the first memorial of its kind in the state, a place to remember those little lives that were here for such a short time. She spoke with Lois Connolly, a woman who can finally now tell her own story.
I'm Maureen McGinnis.
I'm Lois Connolly.
So, Lois, can you tell me again, how many children do you have?
14.
And you were a nurse. What kind of nursing did you do?
I was an LPN nursery nurse at Bellevue Maternity.
So you have a lot of experience with babies.
Yep.
Can you talk a little bit about your second son's birth?
Well, he was born at 6.5 months when I started to bleed and went in the hospital. And he was born, but then he only lived half a day.
Mm-hmm. And did you get to see him?
I got him to see him briefly, uh-huh. Yes.
Okay. Did you get to hold him?
No.
And did your husband see him?
Yes, he did.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And who told you that your son died?
The doctor had called my husband, and my husband came in and told me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then what happened? Who made the arrangements?
I have no idea. After all these years, who made the arrangements? Now I assume it was my mother, mm-hmm. because he was buried at St. Joseph's Cemetery in Waterford, and that was my mother's family's mm-hmm. cemetery. But I didn't know anything about it. No one ever said anything to me or discussed mm-hmm. it. Mm-hmm. It's like hush, hush.
Some of your siblings didn't know about this? Some of your own children didn't know about this?
Well, my own children wouldn't have, because he was the second birth.
Right.
And the oldest was just a baby, you know, a toddler. Mm-hmm. One sister did. She mm-hmm. was at Samaritan, a student nurse, where mm-hmm. I delivered him.
Right.
And another sister who was living at home knew, mm-hmm. but the others never did, mm-hmm. never did.
Right. And so you were not able to be present for his funeral.
No.
Do you know if your husband was? Or?
I don't even know that, because mm-hmm. when I found all this out later, Al had already passed away.
You recently were able to memorialize your son at Most Holy Redeemer Cemetery. What does it mean to you to have a way to memorialize him?
It was wonderful, mm-hmm. wonderful, especially for all the children, my children mm-hmm. and the grandchildren, mm-hmm. to just see his name there in that memories garden
right.
was wonderful.
I think you mentioned that one of your sisters was kind of surprised to even learn that this was something
right.
you went through.
She didn't even know, she told me. Mm-hmm. I found that so hard to believe, because she was living at home, but...
Did you ever talk to any other women who had lost children?
No, I haven't. Mm-hmm. No.
Now, as a person who worked in a maternity hospital, did you see in your career the attitudes or how the death of babies was handled differently from what you experienced
right.
to
yes.
when you
yes.
retired?
Yes, they were encouraged to commit, hold them. Mm-hmm. They took pictures, they dressed them. Mm-hmm. I was never there personally to see it, mm-hmm. but would hear about it. Mm-hmm. Much different.
Right. And so for you, you left the hospital with nothing.
Nothing. Mm-hmm. Yep. Like it was the end.
Right. And you, I think you mentioned that you never really thought about the funeral or burial.
No, I didn't. I don't know why. Whether mm-hmm. I was too young, I don't know. I just never did. Mm-hmm. All the more reason you would think somebody would have said something.
Right. So did you ever feel like this was something people were tiptoeing around you about, or it just became a non-issue?
More or less a non-issue, I think. I think maybe they wanted to spare my feelings, not bring it up. Mm-hmm. I have no idea.
Right. What would you want other mothers to know who went through what you went through at that same time? I mean, for many of the women, this is just something that they're beginning to talk about. Mm-hmm. And I've heard from women who've had recent losses who say it's horrific enough to have the loss, but they can't imagine what it's like to have not talked about
right.
it. What's it been like for you these past few weeks being able to talk about it?
Oh, it was just wonderful. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to describe it. I was just so pleased. Mm-hmm. And then we took pictures at the garden. So I've passed them around, even right. to friends,
yeah.
you know, that didn't know.
Yeah, you were surrounded by quite a few. You had a very large family there with you providing support. So that was
yes.
lovely. And why don't you talk about naming him? How did you come up with the name?
Well, my husband had liked that name at one time with someone he had been in service with, mm-hmm. but we never named our, you know, the other children. I thought, that's what I'll do, I'll name.
So he didn't get his name, but he didn't get the name, your son didn't get his name until just recently.
The Memories Garden, yes. Yeah. It was always just baby boy, and I said, I'm not going to put that in the garden. He's going to have a name.
Right. What was the reaction of your other children when you said you wanted to participate in the Memory Garden?
Oh, they were surprised but pleased. Mm-hmm. In fact, my youngest said, I didn't know anything about this baby. But they were very pleased and glad to come to the ceremony right. at the garden.
Mm-hmm. You had quite a few. Do you remember how many of your children came?
I think maybe 6 or 7.
Mm-hmm. And you guys took pictures. It
yes.
was a very, it seemed like an upbeat family moment
yeah.
for
it
you.
Was.
And it was nice for us to see that you had so much family surrounding you. There were other women who were just there with their ride, you know?
Right.
And didn't have the same kind of support.
Right. I ran
had.
Into a woman there
uh-huh.
that I had worked with at Bellevue.
Uh-huh.
And she had lost one years before, too.
Uh-huh.
So she was going to have her name, I believe, put in.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you know that she had had a loss?
No.
So
no.
this was something you guys had
no.
worked side by side and never talked about?
Right.
Maureen McGinnis is Family Services Manager at Most Holy Redeemer Cemetery in Niskayuna, New York, which has now established a memorial to the infants buried there. Lois Connolly is one of the mothers who attended its opening. Every day in the U.S., 11,000 babies die on the day they're born. According to the co-director of Ohio Better Birth Outcomes, just under 40% of babies born are African American. Yet, they make up 70% of babies who die in the first year of life. It's a huge disparity and a problem that one program in Tennessee may be helping to eliminate. The infant mortality rate in Shelby County, Tennessee is almost double what it is nationally. Among Black women, it's almost triple. Yet, there are programs in the county that help babies make it to their first birthdays with almost 100% success. Eleanor Boudreau looks at how they do it.
Tasha Brown's daughter, Ariana, was just 3 months old when she started having trouble breathing.
Her chest was just moving so fast, and it was to the point where you can literally see her throat go in, and you can see the skin go in.
Brown will always remember that day.
It was snow on the ground, ice, everything. I mean, it was just everything just covered in white. And my car wouldn't crank up.
Brown called an ambulance, which rushed her daughter to the hospital where she was diagnosed with walking pneumonia, and the doctors rushed to drain her lungs.
And as soon as I saw them pull that needle to stick her in her back, she just gave out this little, and she just laid her head down, and she just let them do it. It was so much fluid.
Brown had a high-risk pregnancy. She was young, she's Black, and she didn't find out she was pregnant or get any prenatal care until she was almost 5 months along. She also didn't have a place of her own, and Brown has a serious lung disorder that put her daughter at risk of developing asthma and lung problems after she was born. Brown's daughter almost died.
If I had let her go to sleep that night, she probably wouldn't have woke up.
But Brown's daughter didn't die. Brown is a participant in the county's Healthy Start program. The program only works with women who are high risk, yet most of the participants don't lose their kids. Out of 80 pregnant women in the program in 2008, there were no deaths. No fetal deaths, no infant deaths, no deaths. Healthy Start works primarily as a referral program. It refers women to resources for housing, food, clothes, and mental health services. It has a nurse and nutrition educators on staff, and maybe most importantly, Healthy Start offers home visitations by a social worker. Brown says her social worker made all the difference.
And she made me feel like, you know, you can do this, you can finish school, you can get your job. I found a job. I got my apartment, got a house full of furniture now. My kids got their own room, they got their own clothes, you know, I'm better. Because she never let me feel like I could not do anything.
And Healthy Start is also not alone. There are other programs giving non-medical help to pregnant women in Shelby County and coming out with similar success rates. Kimberly Lamar heads up the Blues Project. Less than 1% of Blues babies die. Lamar says the project's social workers are their front lines of defense.
All healthcare needs to address the emotional aspect of health. Adding that to the healthcare model will make a true difference, and maybe that's the key to solving this infant mortality issue.
Natasha Bowers helps women let go of the mental things that affect their health and the health of their babies. Bowers is a social worker for the Blues Project. She says her work is personal.
I was a teenage mother myself, but there was no Blues around. I had someone actually tell me, you're going to be living in the projects, which is stereotypical, and it angers me. So in my mind, if you're telling me this, there's no telling how many other people have said this to our clients.
Late one Monday afternoon, one of Bowers' clients wanders into her office.
Happy New Year.
Jessica Love has had three children with the Blues Project, and they're all with her. Her four-year-old son walks beside her, and she wheels her 16-month-old twins in a double stroller. Love has a lot on her mind. While she was pregnant with her twins, Love lost her job. Now her family is giving her a hard time for not working. Bowers tells her not to argue.
That's the reason why I'm like, let it go and just be you and do what you have to do to take care of you and these children. Focus on you.
And that's where Love is having her second problem. Love says she's applying for jobs, but it's difficult. Her oldest is enrolled in a pre-kindergarten program, but her twins are always with her. When Love's oldest was growing up, Love was working and daycare was provided. After her twins were born, Love tried to enroll them in daycare too, but she got turned down.
Be on a lot of pressure and stress. So wait a minute.
So you tell me that your DHS caseworker said that they cannot do families first child care for you because you are not working?
Bowers says she'll look into it. Still, it's not all bad news. Love's daughter recently learned to walk. Love's twins were born 3 months prematurely, and her daughter has had a lot of medical problems as a result. Love takes the little girl from the stroller, and as she begins to totter around the office, this is the first time Bowers has seen her walk.
Blow me that kiss. Oh, I got it.
This may not be the end of Love's troubles, but whatever happens, all three of her children have made it past their first birthday. Too many children in Shelby County don't. In Memphis, I'm Eleanor Boudreau.
Up next, using nutrition assistance at the farmer's market and doing away with diapers altogether. If you missed part of this show or want to share it, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1267. $7 million Americans are enrolled in the SNAP program, or food stamps. The program is the biggest spending item in the Farm Bill, and the program has a big bullseye on it in Congress. As Grant Gerlach reports for Harvest Public Media, the economic considerations go beyond who receives SNAP benefits to how and where the money is spent.
Walking through the farmer's market with April Segura, it's obvious she's a regular.
Hola, ¿cómo estás?
How are you?
Segura looks over tables of lettuce and herbs at the Old Cheney Road Farmer's Market in Lincoln, Nebraska. She's 31 and a single, stay-at-home mother of three. Two big shopping bags hang from one arm. The other supports her one-year-old son, Jeriel, riding in a sling on her chest. Segura is a SNAP recipient and a local food fanatic.
I love asparagus season, and it's probably about to be over. So, and I didn't get any last week because we were in a hurry, and we barely made it here. So,
Segura depends on around $500 each month from SNAP to help cover her food bills. As much as she can, she uses that money at the farmer's market. Today, she found cabbage and tomatillo to plant in the garden and bright green asparagus for a snack.
And is it four for the bunch? Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
It used to be common for markets to take food stamps, but when paper stamps were replaced by plastic debit cards, not many markets invested in card readers. In recent years, though, there's been a rebound. In 2008, only 750 local farms and markets across the country accepted SNAP. Last year, it was more than 3,000. That means Segura can swipe her card and buy food that otherwise would be hard to afford.
I wouldn't want to just get crap food. Like, you know, for me and my kids, I realize we need to be eating healthy, and we try to do as organic as we can and local as we can.
Customers like Segura pushed SNAP spending at farms and markets to more than $16 million in 2012. But that's hardly a drop in the bucket when you consider government spending on SNAP reached $78 billion last year. It's doubled since the recession. The current debate in Congress is not whether to cut that number, but by how much. The farm bill in the Democrat-controlled Senate would trim an estimated $4 billion over 10 years. For many Republicans, like Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma, that's not enough.
Why would they call this a farm bill if 80% of it is talking about the food stamp program? I can't think of anyone who could rationally say that this program of food stamps could justify being increased by 100% in a period of 4 years.
Meanwhile, a different version of the farm bill in the Republican-controlled House of Representatives would cut SNAP by $20 billion. Many Democrats, including Congressman Jim McGovern of Massachusetts, argue that's unnecessary because SNAP spending would fall on its own.
When the economy gets better and people go back to work, the numbers decline. And as this economy improves, the CBO says this, you'll see fewer and fewer people on SNAP.
Supporters also say SNAP spending is a form of economic stimulus. According to USDA, each dollar of SNAP produces $1.79 in economic activity. Most of that money does not go to farmers markets. The vast majority of SNAP dollars enter the economy through large supermarkets and superstores. Megan Jackson, manager of the market on Old Cheney Road, acknowledges a dollar may buy you more at the grocery store, but it's divided differently.
By the end, the farmer sees 19 cents of that dollar. Here, the farmer sees 99 cents of that dollar.
Jackson says small growers don't receive the same government support as commodity grain farmers. For them, SNAP is like an indirect subsidy.
This is one avenue where that support is direct.
And that's the beauty of being able to come to the market, because, you know, I know this person here and there, and you can come to the market and you can support everyone that you know that you want to support.
This summer, Congress will argue over how much food assistance the government can afford. In the meantime, April Segura, like a growing number of SNAP users, plans to spend as much as she can afford at the farmer's market. I'm Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
And finally, did you ever consider what it would mean to the environment if your children were out of diapers earlier? What if they never wore diapers at all? Lisa Goldberg and Rebecca Steinfeld filed this report for the Homefront Chronicles.
What if you never have to change a diaper for your new baby, and at the same time, save the environment from thousands of disposable diapers?
While pregnant, single mother Angela decided to try raising her daughter without diapers. This practice, known as elimination communication, is a process in which a parent observes a baby's signs and signals and helps them to use the bathroom. Little known in the U.S., it is used regularly in many other countries around the world.
I had never questioned diapers or the use of them or our culture and how we did potty training until I was about 9.5 months pregnant. And a woman came into a birthing class, and she had just given birth and had a little boy. She started cueing, making cueing noises to him while he went to the bathroom. And so I was just blown away by this idea. And I started doing research and found out that historically and all around the world, that's what people have done up until basically 1961 when disposable diapers were introduced. And then that started changing. So it was understood that eliminating, just like eating and sleeping, is something that we are sort of evolutionarily inclined to do. It's not something that we are completely unaware of until 2 years old, which is what we're taught in this culture. So when I started to look into it, I realized that I wanted to have something different for my daughter. It didn't make any sense to have her waddling around in diapers until she was 2 or 3 or 4 or 5, like kids are in the United States. And the United States does have the oldest potty training age in the history of the world. So I started to research that and started to practice it with my daughter, just paying attention to her communication and giving her feedback through elimination cues and doing sign language with her. Started her on a little potty chair at 3 months old, and she would have it between my legs and she would face me. And just developed this really extraordinary bond. She was fully potty trained at 18 months. I saved thousands of dollars on diaper costs and diaper-related situations, and the environmental impact is absolutely enormous. I think it's like 22 million tons of disposable diaper garbage that's put into landfills each year just in the United States. And those disposable, quote unquote, disposable diapers aren't going anywhere. They're going to be around for 400, 500 years. I think it's incredibly important, you know, and especially because we have this huge environmental movement that's going on. And I feel like, you know, going to the Green Festival and the Mother Earth News Festival, and people aren't talking about potty training. It's just kind of like this dirty little secret, you know. Nobody's saying anything about the fact that if we're really wanting to look at our footprint here, yes, buying local food and things like that is very important. But how many kids do you have? 2, 3 kids, or even one? I mean, that's millions and billions of pounds of filth that's sitting in landfills. Those disposable diapers aren't going anywhere. We're training our kids to ignore their bodies, to ignore their bodily sensations for 2 full years. It just doesn't make sense when you really think about it. And so recognizing that here's this little tiny amazing little infant that I had just given birth to, and that she had this awareness and she was indeed communicating with me that she had to go, just I had to stop ignoring those communication feeds that she was giving me. So once I tapped into it, we just took off. And then I'd be in different places where, you know, I would bring the potty chair with us to the beach sometimes, and, you know, we'd be hanging out, and then I'd just put her on the potty and she'd go to the bathroom in it, and people were like, what are you doing? And, you know, then there was my little girl at a year old or year and a half old not wearing diapers, and they're like, oh my God, she isn't wearing diapers. What's going on? Like, well, she's potty trained. She's been done. And the people were just flabbergasted by it. And I recognize that parents can be really stiff when it comes to new ideas, and especially if they have kind of gone with the mode of this culture and raised their kids using diapers and stuff, which it doesn't mean you're wrong, doesn't mean you're bad, but people can be really kind of do a lot of wall building there. And so it's been interesting kind of trying to have the dialogue and saying, look, I'm not pointing fingers at you. I didn't do it perfectly. I didn't do it extreme. I didn't ever use diapers. I mean, I use disposable diapers at times. I use cloth at times. I'm not a hippie. I'm not rich. I don't have a supportive husband. I mean, I didn't sit around all day and watch my child to see when she was going to use the bathroom. Like, there's certain things that you can do in a modern day family, in a modern day environment, in order to make it work better.
Angela Graham is the author of Potty Trained by Two, Wisdom from the Past to Better Our Future. You can find her book at pottytrainedby2.com.
Homefront Chronicles is produced by Lisa Goldberg and Rebecca Steinfeld in Seattle.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. If you'd like to connect with us on Facebook, you can find 51% there, and you can also email me at sbarnett@wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.